Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Today on Virginia Conversations, the impact of whistleblowing from a man who knows firsthand, and the procedures and laws in place to protect whistleblowers in Virginia. I'm Maylilly Lee. Thanks for joining us. In April of 2011, Governor Bob McDonnell signed legislation creating the Office of the State Inspector General, which would handle whistleblower complaints of fraud, waste, abuse, or corruption in the Commonwealth. Mike Morehart is Virginia's State Inspector General and joins us from our Richmond studio. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
And from our studios in WVTF land of Roanoke, we welcome author and former NASA employee Richard Cook, the whistleblower on the Space Shuttle Challenger. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
It's great to have both of you with us. I want to provide a little bit of background. On January 28, 1986, I know you all recall the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded a little over 1 minute into its flight, resulting in the deaths of all seven crew members. The tragedy was blamed on a faulty O-ring seal made by Morton Thiokol. Richard Cook was a NASA employee at the time, and he saw it coming. You know, interesting, people who know your story, Rick, may assume that you were an engineer or you were on the research team, and that's how you knew about this O-ring that became a household word once this was all exposed. But that was far from the truth. You were actually an analyst looking at budgets in the comptroller's office.
Yes, I was a financial analyst, and I was assigned to study the cost implications of problems with the solid rocket boosters. So I got to know the managing engineers on the solid rocket booster program very well. And they told me all about what had been going on with the flaws in the joints of the solid rocket booster, because the thing was assembled and then broken down to reuse. So it was very important that the joints between segments not leak flames during liftoff and afterwards. But that's exactly what was beginning to happen. And they told me all about it.
And this was not new. It was known that there were catastrophic flaws in the O-ring since 1977. Is that about right?
Well, they had had difficulties since the very beginning of the space shuttle program. And they learned with the second shuttle flight, which was in 1981, that flames were beginning to leak through the joints from the inside. And it had been going on, but they were discovering in 1985 was that it became much worse when temperatures at the launch site were low. And that was what eventually caused the joint failure when Challenger blew up.
At what point did it become apparent to you that this was a problem? When did it cross your desk?
This was in July of 1985. It was about 6 months before the Challenger disaster. And I was sent over to the other building there in Washington. We were in the main headquarters building. The Office of Spaceflight was across the street down on Independence Avenue. So my first assignment with these engineers was to go over and find out what was going on with the O-rings, because headquarters knew about this and they were concerned and they wanted some more detail. So I went over, and my very first meeting I had with the solid rocket booster engineers told me this could blow up due to catastrophic failure, and they held their breath with every launch.
So at what point were you stepping out of your role in the comptroller's office? In other words, was safety even a concern for you as someone looking at budgets?
Oh, sure. It had to be, because safety has tremendous implications for design costs, for whether you stop flights and make a repair. Everything that happens with a big complex program like that has financial implications, and you have to have a budget that is able to be flexible enough to accommodate changes that are made. The shuttle had been declared operational back in 1983, And from that time on, developmental funding in the shuttle budget was being radically reduced. So if you ran into a major design problem, you had a real issue on your hands because the money just was not there to fix it. So what they tended to do in those cases was to fly as is. That was the term of art in NASA. You keep flying while you're trying to fix it. And in this case, obviously, that didn't work very well.
You wrote a memo long before the actual launch warning of these dangers. Who did this memo go to?
The memo was written on July 23rd, 1985, and it was an official memo that went to the management of the comptroller's office at NASA headquarters.
Okay. And it was ignored?
Well, I was told to keep observing the problem, and it wasn't just this memo. I filed hundreds of pages of reports during the fall of 1985. All of it went into the offices of the managers of the comptroller's office, and these were things that were reflecting issues that were being discussed at the Office of Spaceflight. So there was nothing internally that was terribly secretive about it. It was simply putting down on paper what was being said, and I would go to these management meetings. And it wasn't just the O-rings. It was other issues as well, and it's all in my book, the numerous problems that NASA was having with the safety of the space shuttle.
Give us the title of your book so folks can look it up.
The title of the book is Challenger Revealed.
Okay. The question has to be asked, here's a memo of warning. You said it wasn't just about O-rings. There were other things. And certainly there were probably other people giving status updates as the launch was approaching. Were things like this routine? Would your warning, quote unquote, really not have been so much a warning, but just part of the whole analytical process?
Well, no, it was not just routine. When you're documenting and reporting on potentially catastrophic issues that could blow up the shuttle and kill people, nobody would classify that as routine.
Let's fast forward to the morning of the launch. Where were you?
I was at the headquarters building in Washington, D.C., and I had just finished a phone conversation with someone on another problem that I was investigating. And I said, well, I want to cut this off because I want to go watch the Challenger launch. I was quite interested in the Teacher in Space program. That Krista McAuliffe, of course, was the Teacher in Space. I really admired her, and I wanted to see the launch. So I went over to the press auditorium at the headquarters building, and there were a lot of people in there watching the launch on a TV monitor. And we saw it happen.
And your reaction?
Well, it was very upsetting. And at first, I just kind of didn't believe it. I thought this was the separation from the main shuttle of the solid rocket boosters. But then very quickly, I realized, and other people in the room realized, something was wrong. And then the announcement came over the NASA network that the flight safety officer has reported that the vehicle has exploded.
But knowing that the O-ring seal was faulty to begin with, did you go in thinking this is not good? This is not good. I'm waking up this morning to a disaster. I know what's going to happen.
No, and this was the irony of it. Because they had told me, and they told other people, the management of the space transportation system, that they were working on this, it was going to be repaired. And in fact, I was scheduled to actually go out to Utah in February to observe the testing of the engineering feature that was supposed to correct the O-ring problem. But I had been involved over a period of several months in investigating another problem with the space shuttle, which was the Centaur upper stage, which is a rocket they were going to put inside the payload bay of the orbiter to release planetary missions once they were out in space. And I had just come back from the Kennedy Space Center for a series of meetings where there was tremendous concern by the astronauts on the safety of that. And I believed, and so did other people, that this was perhaps the greatest threat to the shuttle at the time, and I was involved in writing a 100-page report on this. In fact, when I was down at Kennedy, I saw Challenger on the launch pad getting ready to go. But my attention had actually been distracted by these other issues, and these are also covered in my book. So when the Challenger blew up, I was taken by surprise, and it wasn't till the reports began to come in, and CBS News had some commentary going on about where the explosion seemed to start. And when they said it seemed to start at the joint in a solid rocket booster, I said, oh, wow, this is what I had been reporting on. And I went and pulled my memos out and said, this is it. This is what happened. And the investigation began down at the Kennedy Space Center, and they were viewing films that morning, of that morning when Challenger lifted off, showing puffs of smoke coming out from the solid rocket booster joint. So everybody knew that day what had happened.
While the explosion might have been the culmination of your concerns and your worries, it was really just the beginning. You now found yourself in the middle of a huge cover-up.
Yeah, the information came out later in the investigation about how the meetings had taken place at NASA to decide how they were going to spin this. It actually began to happen. And the main thing was to make these repeated declarations that nobody knew what had happened and that no stone would be unturned. You know, they used those words in the investigation, which was expected to drag out for months in order to determine the cause, whereas everybody knew that day exactly what had happened and that NASA had known about this for years. So I was sitting there, and in fact, my wife and I were watching the news reports at home in the evening, watching this unfold over the next week or so. And it was very obvious to me at that point that the cover-up had been determined.
Who was complicit in this cover-up? Only higher-ups, or was it from the top down?
It was from the top down. But there were a lot of nuances to this. For instance, the administrator of NASA at the time, who had just been put in by the White House, was a man named William Graham. He didn't know the history of the O-rings, and so they were even keeping information from him about what had happened. And he was sent out on television to declare that nobody knew what had happened and everything was perfectly safe and had always been that way.
So you had a moment with your wife. You sat down and thought about whether to leak this, and you did decide to contact the New York Times. What happened?
Well, I had already gone to some people. In fact, I had actually called the commission, the presidential commission that had just been put into place, and talked to somebody in the office there. And I got very uneasy feelings that they were not really going to dig into this very much. And I also went to a couple other people in Washington trying to get some kind of advice or legal help in how to handle these explosive documents that I was carrying around in my briefcase. Basically, nobody was interested. No one wanted to listen to me or give me any help with this. So I called the New York Times and I said, I've got some stuff you should see. And I brought it over there to them and they started going through it and saying, wow, this is really interesting material, and we want to publish it.
And this is interesting, and we'll bring Mike Morehart into this in our next segment as well. But you were hoping that you could provide this leak anonymously. Now,
yeah,
I'm imagining you just
correct.
Didn't want to do any damage to your career, your current job. Yeah, you didn't want to upend any of that.
That's correct, yeah.
That's not what happened.
No. My memo of the 23rd of July, 1985, pretty much captured the whole situation in a very concise way and used quotations from the engineers about a potentially catastrophic failure, that sort of thing. And the reporters down at the New York Times, and this went all the way up to Mr. Sulzberger, who was the head of the New York Times in New York, they said, look, your memo captures what happened, and we think that this has to be in the story. And I said, well, okay. And then they said, and your name has to be put on it. We can't report this as an anonymous memo. I said, no, I don't want to do that. It's going to ruin my career. And they said a very interesting thing. They said, well, it's up to you. If you don't want to do that, we will not publish the story. It's your choice. So I thought about it, and I talked to my wife about it, and I finally realized that it was my duty as a public servant to act in a manner befitting conscience and truth. And so I said, well, okay, let's just see what happens. And so they did. And the story came out on the 9th of February. My name was in it. I began to get calls from the press immediately. And then I was called before the Presidential Commission, who tried to back me down by making it appear that I was just an ignorant analyst who was new on the job and didn't know anything. And I stood my ground. I said, this is what the engineer said. This is what they told me. And at that point, the a story began to come out of how the engineers from the contractor, Morton Thiokol, had argued for hours the night before the launch to stop the launch. And they, too, were ignored, even though they were saying that because of the cold weather, this could fail and the space shuttle could blow up the next morning. So it kind of opened the floodgates and the story just broke and came out. And that's why today the public knows what happened with Challenger. It was because we whistleblowers decided we just couldn't go along with it and had to tell the truth.
You use the term we whistleblowers, but in fact, you were alone at NASA.
Well, I was the first one out of the gate, so to speak, and I was on my own. I had a close colleague over there in the Office of Spaceflight who was giving me documents that eventually ended up in the press, even though he told me, please don't leak these. He and I both knew I was going to.
And did you fear more? Did you fear for more than just your job? Did you ever fear for your life?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I was given some warnings by members of the press who'd covered these types of stories before. Nothing this big, but yeah, I was given warnings that my life could be in danger for doing this, and so that also contributed to my resolve. And I finally concluded, and I wrote this in my book. If I had any advice to whistleblowers. Don't hesitate. Don't back down. If you're going to strike, strike hard and make a stand for yourself. That's your best protection.
Did you feel at any time that this was it? You were never going to find another job in the federal government?
Well, I had planned to transfer to the U.S. Treasury Department, and I did report to work there. After my testimony before the Presidential Commission, I never went back to NASA. I was told that your name there is not welcome, and so I took sick leave the rest of the week. And in fact, I had thrown my back out with back spasms. I was on crutches that week, and it was kind of a fear reaction. So I didn't go back, but I did go to Treasury. But I was still speaking out at Treasury about the circumstances of the launch and being interviewed by the Presidential Commission. But they protected me. The civil service there in Treasury kept me from being fired.
We're talking with Richard Cook, former NASA employee who blew the whistle on the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. Next week, we're heading into the kitchen for some Thanksgiving recipes. We'll have more after this break in just a moment. Today, we are discussing the rewards and ramifications of being a whistleblower. Our guests are author and former NASA employee Richard Cook. He wrote a book in 2007 called Challenger Revealed about the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster. And also joining us, Virginia's State Inspector General Mike Morehart, who will be talking about some of the protections afforded whistleblowers here in Virginia. And we're glad to have both of them with us. Going back to you, Rick, if we could, about what happened in the subsequent months? First of all, we should say that once this disaster occurred, it was about a 2.5-year hold that took place.
That's right.
On shuttle programs. So I'm wondering almost, I'm trying to get to the reason why it would be so imperative to cover all of this up. Why coming forth with, you know what, it was the O-ring. We don't need to do this big charade with a commission to pretend like we don't know. We don't have to have all of our top-level managers pretend that they didn't know there were problems with O-rings and other issues. And just come out with that. Perhaps one of the reasons I'm trying to draw a conclusion here is that no one wants to put the program in jeopardy.
There's that, but there's also a tremendous reluctance or resistance on the part of a big organization, especially one like NASA, that was such an important part of the fabric of American life, to admit they had really, you know, done an incredible blunder, and that they had risked people's lives, they had lost people's lives over things that had such a long history to it and that they knew about and did not stop. So I think there's the face-saving aspect of it. There's also the political aspect of it, and I get into this very heavily in my book because I drew the conclusion, and I put forth a lot of evidence for that, that the reason that NASA overrode the engineers' warnings and launched that morning was partly political. I think they were under pressure from the White House to get the teacher in space up there.
Let's talk about that briefly.
Yeah.
You drew a conclusion that part of the rush was so that perhaps President Reagan could talk to Christa McAuliffe live while she was in space.
Yes, that was
part of the State of the Union.
Yeah, that was denied, of course. But there are a number of press reports that this was going to be the case. Very reliable reports, and for instance, the Washington Post. And then when Dr. Richard Feynman, the well-known member of the Presidential Commission, the Nobel Prize winner, went around doing his own interviews, he learned from the Jet Propulsion Lab out in California that a channel had actually been cleared and opened for the president to call the space shuttle that night. And I put in my book all of the evidence for that and was convinced that there was pressure from the White House and that was the immediate reason that NASA was putting so much pressure on Thiokol to overturn their engineering judgment and to approve the launch. So you had all of the political ramifications there too. And whenever you're touching politics and the reputation of top political people, you're walking on eggshells, and everybody in the government knows that and always knew that. So there was that whole political element of it also, and I was bucking that. I came out in the open, and I said to the press that I think this is what happened. And that was when the order came down from political levels at Treasury to get rid of this guy. And the career managers that I was working with said, no, he hadn't done anything wrong. We're not going to do it.
In your book, you describe NASA's thick bureaucracy, the autocratic management style that led to this kind of cover-up and this inability to look at some truths. And one would draw the conclusion that this could be true of NASA and just about any other similar organization.
Yeah, I really could. Top-down management, I think, is something that we really need to examine. You know, you had this whole movement coming in of management by objectives, where management sets the goal and everybody else has to work toward it. But what that can become very easily is an autocratic environment, where management just gives the orders, and regardless of what the reality of the situation is, everybody has not only to scramble to meet those orders, but if something goes wrong, they're supposed to keep their mouth shut. And I think we've really gone wrong in our culture with that. This was not the way the original NASA program was. The Mercury program or the Apollo program, the astronauts were involved intimately in every phase of operations. In design, in scheduling, and they would not launch something if an astronaut said, don't do it, particularly after the Apollo 1 fire that killed the three Mercury astronauts. After that, you wouldn't do it if the people involved in the program weren't comfortable with it. But we've lost that, I think, to a considerable degree.
The complete title of your expose is Challenger Revealed, an insider's account of how the Reagan administration caused the greatest tragedy of the space age.
Right.
By the way, that's a subtitle that wouldn't fly in broadcast. You'd need to tighten that.
Yeah.
However, my question, and you do draw lots of correlations to the Reagan administration from the Rogers Commission on down. My question is, would this have been just as plausible in an Obama administration?
Yes, I think it would. I think the situation is the same, and I think you've got an unfolding scenario here with all of the surveillance that's going on from the National Security Agency, where you've got some major whistleblowers who have come out of the woodwork there, Thomas Drake, Edward Snowden, and so on. I think you've got a very similar situation of cover-ups and leaks going on with some of these surveillance systems that are going on that are very similar.
All right, Rick, give us your website so people can find out more about your works.
It's www.richardccook.com. And be sure you put the C in there, richardccook.com.
And stay with us because now we're going to turn to Mike Morhart, Virginia's State Inspector General. Good morning to you. You've been listening to Rick's story.
Yes, most interesting. Good morning to you.
Give us a little bit of background on the Inspector General's role in Virginia.
Certainly. The Inspector General's role, well, actually, let me start with its creation back in July of 2012 when legislation was signed by Governor McDonald creating it. The role of the Inspector General's office is multifold, but I'd sum it up in three areas. We're responsible for conducting performance reviews on state agencies. Essentially, those are defined as reviews of operations, procedures, processes, programs to maximize the efficiency, the best use of citizens' resources, if you will. We're also responsible for overseeing internal audit programs in all the Commonwealth's agencies, of which there are about 109. Some have them, some don't. We set standards and ensure they're operating as they're intended. Also importantly, we're responsible for conducting investigations into fraud, waste, abuse, and corruption involving state agencies. So those are our three primary functions. There are some sub-functions, if you will, such as managing the Whistleblower Reward Act and overseeing hotline functions where any citizen of the Commonwealth can call in complaints about Commonwealth entities or anything related to the Commonwealth.
There aren't as many whistles out there as one might imagine.
No.
Explain.
Well, we operate the hotline, the State Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Hotline, and we'll give the number later if that's all right with you and how to get in touch with us. That's open to all citizens. And we get a lot of calls from different folks, citizens and state employees that lodge complaints about various and sundry things. We take each of them seriously and we evaluate them and decide whether to look into them or not. Obviously, as you might imagine, some people call the hotline when they have a problem with their supervisor, for example, on a performance issue. That's really out of bounds for us. We're not looking at HR-type matters, if you will, generally speaking, unless there's something egregious or unique about it. But we look into all of those. And the nice thing about the hotline is that individuals can call in toll-free and do not have to identify themselves if they so choose. What will happen when they call in, they'll be given a number, a file number. So if they want to call back and discuss it with one of our staff to bring up additional issues, they can just use that number and not identify themselves if they so choose.
So I should point out that you've received hotline tips, but full-blown whistleblowing accounts have just not happened yet.
Correct.
When we talk about who would be targeted, are these just state agencies or could people call about a private employer?
You know, they can, and sometimes they do. And what we do in those circumstances, because our jurisdiction is limited to the Commonwealth, and certain non-state agencies, and it gets technical, but wholly or principally funded by the Commonwealth, we can look at. But generally speaking, we will try to refer them to the appropriate private entity or law enforcement entity or other entity as necessary to help them address their issue if it's outside of our jurisdiction.
What is that hotline number?
The hotline number is 1-800-723-1615. Again, that's 1-800-723-1615.
Okay. You used to be an FBI
agent
for a long, long time.
Correct.
So the type of work that you did before parlays pretty well into what you're doing now. You said you like being active. You like getting out there. And
absolutely.
I would add a little bit, you know, just digging up that dust that's settled. Do you think that there's just not a lot there because of what Rick refers to, that others around him weren't interested in doing anything except being complicit?
Well, you know, going back to my time as an FBI agent, there are folks who don't want to get involved because they believe they may be retaliated against, much as Rick ostensibly was, or don't think it's in their best interest to be involved, or just don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. What about you, Rick? You know, you make an interesting point that once you hit go, you might as well just go all the way.
Well, that was my sense of it. And also, there was a matter of, I think, of a certain personal integrity there where you feel that you are now part of the situation and that you have a responsibility to yourself, to your own honesty, your own integrity, to stand up take whatever comes. But you have the truth on your side. And that's what you're faithful to. And that appeals to a very deep level, I think, of individual conscience, of individual self-worth. And I just can't even imagine how I would feel today if back 25 years ago I had just gone along with what was happening, suppressed what I knew. And I think I also was put in a position by fate or whatever you want to call it, of being the man in the middle who had all of the strands of information that the public needed to know about. We're a democracy. The public has a right to know what their government is doing. They had a right then. They have a right now. And the only way that that can be fully manifested is for individuals within the system to act according to conscience, not according to fear, not according to official orders, but to have their own sense of right and wrong and to stand up for it.
I would imagine that many, many people listening now would say, oh, yeah, I would do exactly what Richard Cook did. I wouldn't hesitate to blow that whistle. But there are many social experiments out in the world that demonstrate otherwise. The Milgram experiment, for instance, conducted by Yale University psychologist Stanley Milgram, which measured the willingness of participants to obey an authority figure. Do you remember this?
Yes.
People were asked to push a button that would administer an electric shock, and people would hear screams of varying degrees on the other end. Of course, these were made-up screams, but the subjects didn't know this. And because the authority figure said, keep pushing, the majority of participants in that study kept pushing despite the screams. And I find that fascinating. It does take thinking outside of the box, if I could use just an old trite saying, in order for someone to sort of break out of that.
Yeah, and this nation, our nation, has a lot of problems right now. But I think that the integrity of the individual is what can save us, if I can go that far. You know, what will make this country strong and free into the future is the conscience of individuals who feel from their own deepest spiritual center, I've got to do the right thing. And the right thing is always the generous thing. It's always the thing that gives from the heart, whether it's in the job, whether it's in family life, whatever it may be. And that I think we have a tremendous resource of in this country. Sometimes it gets hidden. And that's what I think it all comes back to. And I think that's what our founding fathers found, the Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, we the people. We the people who are good of heart, who are strong of spirit, we're the ones who will make the difference. And so we have to do that.
Richard, I'm going to call upon you to read that letter you and I discussed. I know after this whole story came to light, you received much positive feedback from people, many of whom wrote you letters saying thank you. Thank you for stepping forward. Could you read one of them?
Yes. I'm going to read an excerpt from a letter I've received after my testimony to the Presidential Commission. This was from a woman in Vermont. And it's I found it quite profound, so much so that I put it in my book. And she says, "Dear Richard, I am writing this letter because I have a message for you. In every system, God puts someone to break the system. You are the one that God put in the system. How do you break the system? By not going along with it. You will be challenged to do something that is wrong and against your system. Stand up for right, and God will be with you. This is the time to stand up and be counted." Then she goes on to say further, "You will be opening the door for good ways to come in and the young to come in and help. They are strong in God and will show us the way. We will be rooting for you to come through. We love you for hanging in there when the going got tough. As the saying goes, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. That was nice to hear.
Absolutely. One of your admirers said that you changed his or her life.
Yes. I got an email actually not that many years ago from a person who had been close to the astronauts. There was a personal friendship involved. And she had felt, as many others did, that what they were hearing initially was not the real story. And she told me that the fact that I had come forward and then wrote the book about it to explain all of the intricacies of what had happened during that time actually changed her life and gave her peace, whereas she had been feeling just anguish about what had happened.
And did you find that there was an equal measure of detractors and supporters?
I had no detractors until my book came out, and then there were some internet things about how I felt it was kind of an attack among certain factions in the internet that didn't like me criticizing the government or the space program or the Reagan administration or whatever. But I never got any personal detractors at all during the whole 25 years between the incident and when my book came out.
And so your overall feeling was you'd do it again?
Absolutely.
And what were the biggest lessons for you?
That you reach a point in your life where you're challenged, your ethics are challenged, and it makes all the difference what you do at that point. It sets you on a course that will last your whole life. And these key points are ones you just have to be very aware of and do the best you can and realize you're really not alone. Every person of goodwill is with you.
We're talking with NASA whistleblower Richard Cook. The book is called Challenger Revealed. And also joining us is Virginia's State Inspector General, Mike Morhart. This reminder that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. And find out about upcoming topics and comment on past ones on Facebook. Search for Virginia Conversations and like us. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
Today we're talking about modern whistleblowing. Our guests are former NASA employee Richard Cook and Virginia's State Inspector General Mike Morhart. Mike, what are the protections offered to people who might come forth?
Sure. When folks call our hotline, obviously, as I described before, they can be anonymous if they want. That's one obvious protection that they have. The other is this. The Code of Virginia stipulates that no one will retaliate against a whistleblower or someone that files a complaint against the Commonwealth, and that's taken very seriously by our office. We've had a number of instances where folks have come forward to us and said, hey, I reported this to you, then my boss did this to me. We don't wait. We go investigate that, and we take appropriate action. The individual who may retaliate is subject to standards of conduct issues that's administered by the Department of Human Resources Management in the Commonwealth. And basically what that means is if the individual is found to have retaliated, it can be anything from an oral reprimand, don't do it again, with follow-up by us, to dismissal. So there are a number of protections in place, and I would encourage anybody who has called our hotline who feels like there's reprisal or whatever inappropriate action might have been taken against them to call us. We will address it.
Give us, I promise. That hotline number one
more
time.
The hotline number is 1-800-723-1615.
And folks, this is not about human resources issues.
No.
If you were wronged because of your paycheck, this would not be the number to call. It's about egregious acts that are endemic to an organization, whether it's fraud.
waste, abuse, or corruption.
Right. And how do we know that your office is an independent and neutral office?
Sure. Our organization, our agency, was established to report to the governor's chief of staff. That's who I report to. I do not report to a secretary, as is normally the case for other agencies in the Commonwealth.
Okay. We have a call from Beverly. Good morning to you. You're calling from Orange.
Yes.
What's your question or comment?
Well, I was driving a school bus in a county in Virginia that I won't name. I was on a special needs run, which involves having another person on the bus, an attendant. I was driving along down the road, and I was looking in the mirror, and I saw the attendant slap a child across the face. And in that instant, I thought of pulling the bus over, getting my cell phone, and calling local law enforcement, but I didn't. I went through channels in the county school bus, you know, their channels, and that was the biggest mistake I could have made. They just took her off my bus and put her on another bus. So I emailed the school board and gave them a heads up. They might want to watch the tape of this incident and rethink whether this woman needs to be around children. Well, then the school bus people came after me in a big way. They didn't fire me, but they made it so ugly for me that I wound up quitting. So I was just wondering if your guests had any comments about anything I should have or could have done differently that would have saved my job and gotten the person out of that system where she wouldn't be around children anymore.
Mike, what do you think?
Well, I don't know if you have an ombudsman in that locality. I would recommend if you do that you maybe now even still go to that individual. Even though that's really outside the jurisdiction of the state IG, if you had contacted us, we probably would have put you in touch with, after doing a bit of research, who we could have put you in touch with, but probably local law enforcement to try to assist you with that.
Beverly,
yeah, the tape was forwarded to the police department, the sheriff's department. They kicked it up to the Commonwealth's attorney, and he said there wasn't enough to prosecute.
When the three of you hear this story, and Beverly, you tell your own story, what is anyone's suspicion here as to why she would be protected? Why protect the attendant?
She was the daughter of a close personal friend of the head of pupil transportation.
Got it. Have you since found gainful employment?
Yes, I have. I moved out of that county, and I'm doing well. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your call. I want to turn to you, Mike. Oftentimes, people do report within the system. You heard Rick did the same. He went to people within the federal government rather than immediately going to press. A lot of people do this and they find they're in trouble. College campuses are a great example of that. College campuses, as a rule, do not want to report their crimes. So if there is something reported within the school system, of course there's a tendency to keep it hush-hush rather than put it on police blotters.
Sure. Absolutely. You know, I want to congratulate Beverly and thank her for having the courage to step forward in that particular instance, even though it may not have turned out as positively as she would have liked. You know, I can't speak to the psychology of why people report things or don't or why they behave the way they do. But generally speaking, when we're talking about individuals, they are self-interested. And what I mean by that, is encompassed in the typical definition of corruption. That is misuse of official position for benefit of self. And that can be, as people might think, money, which is typically considered, but it might be, as Rick alluded to earlier, to avoid embarrassment or for political reasons or whatnot. You know, that's one reason I'm proud to be associated with the IG. We are not a political entity. We're interested in doing the right thing, and one of our mantras is simply accountability and integrity in government. And I encourage folks, and I wanted to say thank you to Rick for the courage that he displayed in standing up making the Challenger issue known and the cover-up that, ostensibly took place. Courage is a good thing. It is not without fear, though, and that's what I think holds a lot of people back, much in Beverly's situation where she lost her job over this. People, think down the road, what are the consequences to me for this? But that's the reason we've set the hotline up the way we did, so that you do not have to identify yourself, so that you can avoid some of those consequences. And my great hope is that, particularly as pertains to our jurisdictional area, the Commonwealth, that folks will call in and let us know if they have concerns, even the slightest concern. There may be nothing to it, or there might be, but if people don't call, we don't know, and our office can't do something about it.
Sadly, Beverly didn't have an advocate, and she ended up walking out to hopefully a better job situation. In your case, Rick, you went to the Treasury. You had years of service there. Is that right?
I did. I worked for 21 years after leaving NASA
The benefit that you were able to take advantage of was that you were offered protection.
I was, yeah. I was in a rather obscure part of the U.S. Treasury Department, where even the people all the way to the top were career civil servants. And they were very supportive. They approved of what I did. They did not try to dissuade me from continuing to speak out. I published some articles about it. And then about 5 years later, I received a National Whistleblowers Award called the Cavallo Foundation Award. We had a ceremony in Washington that I went to, and they gave me annual leave to go to that. So it was a very positive environment where I ended up, and I was glad to be there. And I worked there for 2 decades.
What are other stories of whistleblowing that motivate you, either you, Rick, or you, Mike?
You mentioned my career in the FBI. I think one of the moments that I was most proud of the FBI, if we'll think about the war on terrorism, where there were a number of interrogations ongoing and some questionable practices that were utilized on individuals. If you'll recall, FBI agents stood up and said, no, we're not going to do that.
Can you be specific about where?
I don't remember all the details. I remember the general nature of it. It was overseas. Another federal agency was involved in interrogations.
But you're not talking about Abu Ghraib.
Don't think it was Abu Ghraib, but I wouldn't swear to it.
Okay.
But the bottom line is I was very proud of the FBI in that circumstance and those individuals in particular, because that did take a lot of courage. It's easy to go with the flow sometimes and with peers and so forth. And those individuals knew what was wrong, stood up and said so, and would not participate in it, and made it clear to the FBI's management, who then took action and addressed it.
But let's be clear, that's not always the outcome.
Oh, absolutely not. It's not. But that circumstance is circumstance epitomizes to me how the human condition can act with integrity, even in difficult situations where it might be easy to go along to get along, but doing the right thing is the right thing and there is no other alternative.
What about you, Rick?
Well, I think there's still a lot in our culture, in our society, that we need to focus on that are still festering in our history. Going back, for instance, all the way to the Kennedy assassination and continuing on, in the 1970s, Senator Frank Church held hearings to disclose a lot of the things that the CIA had done over the years that they had kept secret. But there are other things out there. I know when the big changes occurred in the Latin American nations after the terrible situations in the 80s and 90s where the military governments were torturing people, they came out with what they called truth commissions to really delve into these things and find out what had happened in these historical events and who was responsible. I think in a lot of cases, we need in this country a truth commission to delve into certain things. I mentioned earlier the programs going on now with the National Security Agency with domestic surveillance. There are other situations. I think there are untold stories having to do with the housing bubble and how that was created. And how the agencies of the government kind of turned a blind eye to the liar's loans that were endemic in the mortgage industry, for instance, that should have been noted and stopped. We have a long way to go, I think, to really delve into things in our recent history that we need to understand better and to allow and provide a forum for insiders who were part of those situations to come forward and tell us what really is going on.
While you're talking about conspiracies, I'll go on a ledge. Would you include 9/11?
I would. And I think here we have a very predominant case where Sybil Edmonds was fired from her job when she revealed prior knowledge of the planned attacks by terrorists using airplanes. So stories like that, yeah, are yet to be fully delved into on an official basis. I'm not talking about just investigative reporters or people writing conspiracy books. We had a good example with the 1974 House Select Committee on Assassinations, which demonstrated that the Kennedy assassination was likely a conspiracy. They used that word. It wasn't just, you know, a theorist writing from speculation. It was an official government investigation. We need to have more of those.
Well, I don't necessarily wholly disagree with you, Rick, but I would add this, that you have to be careful when you're conducting investigations. I've done many, many, many during my career with the FBI, and conclusions can be drawn based upon insufficient evidence sometimes, and that's what you have to be careful of. I would argue a little differently. I would argue that those individuals who are knowledgeable, who have information about, say, the issues that you're talking about, I think they need to come forward. I think all the commissions in the world, while it would certainly be a benefit, and I don't mean to disagree with you there, but all the commissions in the world will not take the place of individuals who have information stepping forward and doing the right thing.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
Another book you've come out with, Rick, is We Hold These Truths, The Hope of Monetary Reform. Can you give us a synopsis of that?
Yes. I learned a lot when I was working for the U.S. Treasury, particularly about the monetary system of this country. And in fact, after I retired in 2007, I was one of those that year who predicted the crash of 2008. Because it was very obvious to me that the debt that our economy was carrying was absolutely unsustainable. When we compared the numbers on debt to equity, for instance, I, along with some other commentators, were saying this cannot go on. You cannot pay that amount of debt with the amount of wealth that's being produced through the equity of the nation. And that's exactly what happened. And so my book went through that scenario and explained it. And also, there's a whole range of alternative monetary reforms that have been put forward by people both outside and inside the government for decades to replace this massive debt machine that the Federal Reserve is at the head of and that the big banks are behind, where we need to find a way to create a circulating medium of exchange to fuel the legitimate economic activity of this nation without the massive debt load that everybody has to carry. And we're right in the middle of that right now. You just simply have to look at how much debt students come out of college with, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 in debt that they're going to spend their whole lives trying to pay off. And you cannot discharge that debt through bankruptcy because of the so-called reform of the bankruptcy laws. So all those issues I began to study and wrote this book about.
Do you think our debt limit disaster is irretrievable?
Well,
we're just heading down a path.
We are, yeah. You can't support that amount of debt. And the way that governments often approach this is by deliberately inflating the currency. Because if they do that, then they can pay their debt down with dollars of less value. And so a debt load of this amount has a tremendous inflationary impetus behind it, and that can be catastrophic. We are all at an impasse right now. There has to be a major change in the way public finance is carried out in this nation.
What would that look like?
Well, I have my own theories about that. One is the generation of financial power by the central government for infrastructure improvements, for instance. The federal government has really declined tremendously in the way it supports the creation of infrastructure in this country, which is why so many bridges, you know, have problems. Railroad construction is way behind the rest of the world. Production of power and energy is something that's reached a breaking point. You need a much greater involvement of the central government in creating and sustaining infrastructure. And also you have the problem of continuing to give away jobs to foreign countries. So many of our jobs have been outsourced overseas, and we're seeing even more of that with this Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement coming along. The people just cannot earn enough money to pay their bills and to avoid debt. That has to change.
former NASA whistleblower Richard Cook. Give us your website so folks can find out about the projects you're working on.
It's www.richardccook.com.
Mike Morhart is Virginia's state inspector general. Can you give us one more time the hotline number for people to call? And we'll remind everyone that when they call the hotline about any tip, any kind of egregious activity that might be going on in the state, they can remain anonymous.
Absolutely. And they can also do it by an email, if I might provide that as well.
Sure.
The phone number is 800-723-1615, and the email is covhotline@osig.virginia.gov, and Virginia needs to be spelled out.
This show has been about whistleblowing in the Commonwealth. I want to thank State Inspector General Mike Morhart and Richard Cook. Thanks to you for listening and joining in today's conversation. Join us for next week's edition of Virginia Conversations right here on this station. Our pre-Thanksgiving cooking program. We did this last year, and it was so much fun. We're going to talk with cookbook author Kendra Bailey Morris and Patrick Eamon, who's the executive banquet chef of Richmond's historic Jefferson Hotel. So join us for next week's edition of Virginia Conversations right here on this station. Until then, I'm Maylily Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.